I ended up staying back at Wat Pah Pong and being around Ajahn Chah. And I want to try to keep the details kind of sparse. There's so much I could say about this period, but his health had been failing for some time, and he'd been diagnosed initially with diabetes, and was doctors were attempting, let's say, to keep him on some kind of regime, watch his sweets intake, and I believe was taking medicine at one point to help with that. And as the rains retreat approached, and this would have been the rains retreat, I believe, of 1981, this well-known monastery, Wat Tham Seng Phet, where I first met Ajahn Sumedho, where I spent my first rains retreat, very beautiful place. Kun Ying Tun, a very wealthy supporter of his, who had built this huge meditation hall, one of the biggest you would ever see, and a huge Buddha image and a reclining Buddha. And Tham Seng Phet, it's translated as the Cave of the Diamond Light, and it had caves and just a beautiful kind of setting for a monastery. And also on top, right almost next door to this big meeting hall, assembly hall, she built him a lovely hut, or not even a hut, it was a cottage. I guess that would be accurate, a cottage, yeah. It was not, like, in all sense, it had a water tank underneath to collect rainwater, and was done in all this beautiful stone and mosquito screening on the inside, and nice toilet shower and everything. It was very, very well done. So his intention was to go there for that rains retreat with his failing health and just kind of chill, really to have some downtime, because here's a man you've seen from the films, all that we're talking. This man is basically giving 24 hours a day, other than he's asleep or he's in the privacy of taking care of the calls of nature. People are with him. They're around him. And we can only imagine the drain that must be. So here's this great master really starting to feel his limitations and his health failing. And so we went up there for him to rest, and I had the kind of rather unpleasant and arduous task of trying to control in some way access to him. So you can imagine everybody was used to hundreds, thousands of people when they arrived that he was there, he was available. And all of a sudden, old Pabakro here had to be the one to kind of stand in the way and be the one to kind of regulate the time and the access and when, with his permission. This is what he wanted. And, of course, nobody could understand that time is kind of no time. It's like, so it was a very difficult task that I found myself in. But we did fairly well, and he had a fair bit of rest time. And I want to tell just one funny story before I go into the details of that and kind of to build up to his, I think, final where he deteriorated to where he quit speaking. We were sitting one evening in the quiet of this monastery, and again, painting the picture, the top of this mountain. It'd be a beautiful place for observatory. You would go outside at night, and you could just see every star in the sky. It was like you could reach up and touch them. And the air was cool and crisp because it was this hilltop and not a mountain as we would know it, but a beautiful kind of elevated setting and a lot of stone and just a wonderful place. And even though it would be cool at night, the stones would hold the heat and you get a little bit of heat off the stone. And so we were sitting in the quietness of this little cottage there. And he had a favorite drink. He called it a communist. And it was kind of his way of saying it was a combination of honey, cocoa, and Coffee Mate. And Coffee Mate was one of these things that we determined was allowable. And of course, we all think it kind of cringe thinking of Coffee Mate now, but it was, in those days, it was something that we determined would allow. And it made a delicious drink and had a very nice taste. So he says, Pabakro, make me a communist. So I went in and, you know, I knew how to mix it just right for him. And the right amount of sweetness and cocoa and the Coffee Mate. And it was rich and thick. And you know, when you don't only eat one meal a day, and this is like better than, you know, a chocolate mousse, or the equivalent of a chocolate mousse. And we're sitting there and he's sipping his drink, and there were one or two, maybe half a dozen monks around just sitting quietly, and he's kind of sipping his drink. And just sitting there. And he said, sabay no, which means, just translates as contentment, happiness, right? And I just kind of, you just kind of raise your hands and wouldn't even say anything, just kind of acknowledging that he had said something. And he said, ekat yang diyo. He says, there's one thing missing. I says, ben yang long pa, kat yang. He says, you know, what's missing? He says, kat pu ying. Which translates as, no women. I think that was more for me. I had gone to stay the pansa with him, and as you'd heard earlier, that it was kind of a coveted position to be his personal attendant, which was kind of handed around between monks and novice monks and kind of back and forth. But since we'd taken this trip together and things, and we had a very close relationship, in that I think he felt a lot of comfort around me and that I was big. One of his symptoms was a kind of a dizziness. Sometimes he would be kind of unsteady on his feet. And I just had growing sensitivity on this trip with him, being close by him to take his arm and whatever. So this kind of just a connection in a way that no one else had really developed with him. And so it was like he was drawing me in. And the humility of the life is one that one definitely wants to be invited into, that space. So never would assume anything. At least I wouldn't, and I think most everybody here would agree with that. So that they were always sensitive and open to that there was an invitation to help and to kind of fill in this spot. And so as we would move around on when he'd go for little walks, he'd always like me. And he'd say, oh, yeah, Prabhakara, I like him nice and close. He's big, he's strong, and he can kind of hold me up, catch me if I fall. So it was this kind of growing comfort, as I was saying, that he had with me. And during that rains retreat, he started to go around, and it was traditional for him to visit the branch monasteries. And he had a very kind of pressing need to do this in this particular rains retreat, because there had been a problem with one of the senior monks, and there had been some rumors about some very inappropriate behavior by this particular senior monk. And of course it was just rumor, but he wanted to go around. It was like his last, it was almost like the Buddha before his parinirvana. He wanted to go around and see his disciples and give these kind of final teachings. So he had a car available, and he went around to visit these various monasteries. And he would usually always say, you know, he'd say, get your bowl and let's go. And so I'd always wait for him to say that. Even though I'd prepare his stuff, I would always wait for him to say, you know, let's go. You know, if you get, go with me, to come with me. So one day he hadn't said that. I had his bowl ready. He was all robed up. Driver was there, and they're in the car. And he hadn't said it, so I wasn't going, as far as I was concerned. And so I put him in the car and help him with the seat belt. And he looks, he says, where's your robe? Where's your bowl? And I says, well, I haven't prepared it. He says, get it. And it was the kind of the last time that I assumed from then on that I was to be with him, that he wanted me, that it was a gesture that it had developed to the sense that I knew that he always wanted me around, so that I just assumed I would go unless I heard otherwise, which was an incredible honor. And during that time, one of the main messages that he was giving to his senior monks, and these are his most senior disciples that he was most concerned with, was the possibility of deteriorating or inappropriate behavior that might strike anywhere unexpectedly. And here it was, in this rumor of this quite senior monk of his, and everything from people wanting to persecute this monk, to not wanting to believe it, to not thinking it was possible, and the whole kind of range of what people felt about that. But his constant reiteration was that this is something that you need to hold, to contemplate, to investigate the facts. And it was his way of saying that this is a communal affair. We need to hold this as a community, look at it as a community, and make a judgment as a community. And so he was emphasizing and reiterating this everywhere that we went.